take a piece of candy, and he didn't even have to pay. But I did have to pay, so all week, when my dad came home from work, I'd check his trouser pockets for loose change. When it looked like I might have enough, I'd walk down to the store, the bell would ring, and the old man would grin and nod, and I'd pace up and down the aisles, like a curator at an art museum, figuring out what candy acquisition I would make with my pocket change. I'd take my choice to the register and spread my change on the counter. I never knew if I had enough, so I'd look at the old man in the eye to learn if I had the right number of pennies and nickels. He would smile and in a low, gentle voice, slowly count my hoard. I remember that his vest always smelled like pipe tobacco, and he would lean into the counter between the jars and stacks of paper bags and move my change around like a banker. When he had counted to the right number, he'd slide the candy bar my way, scoop up the part of the money that was his, and give the rest back to me. I usually didn't wait to get home before eating the candy either. I'd stay in the company of the storekeeper and watch him bag groceries for whoever else came in. I'd like listening to the small talk, predictions about the weather, or the happenings in town. The topic of conversation wasn't important. It was just the kind of place where you wanted to linger. The storekeeper would hear the same small-town gossip over and over every day, but each time he'd listen and respond, as though each customer were sharing the news for the first time. One morning, after having collected enough change from my dad, I ambled down to the store, chose my candy bar, and sprinkled my change before the storekeeper like a pirate's bounty. He began his usual process, separating the coins into rows like he always did. He counted in his gentle voice, stopping to remind me what each coin was worth. He asked me to count out loud with him. I usually stopped counting after 11 or 12, and he would finish up for us without making me feel bad. Somehow, he made it like we were both still counting. When he was done, I looked into his eyes to see if I had enough. He'd usually give me half a nod and a small grin to let me know I did. On this morning, though, things were different. When he finished counting, he shook his whiskered face and squinted. It was the first time this had happened, and I suppose this meant I didn't have enough. "We're one penny short," he said sympathetically. When you're a kid, one penny is an impassable divide, and you can feel really alone when it's just you. But he said, "we," and it made me feel like we were in this thing together, that my goal was his. "I've got an idea," the storekeeper said after a couple of long moments. He grabbed one of the pennies as he reached behind the counter for an old rag and a bottle of vinegar. He poured a little vinegar over the rag and put a pinch of salt on it. "I know exactly what you feel like." He grinned and he started rubbing the penny. "I know what it feels like to really want something and to come up short." This was the longest sentence he had ever said to me. "I really love watching over the store," he went on while I eyed the coin like it was part of a magic trick. "And I love that you come in to see me so much." It felt like I was in some rite of passage. I was the one making small talk with the storekeeper now. I thought I'd mimic other conversations and bring up the weather, but he jumped in with a statement that changed everything. As he finished rubbing the penny, it was a brilliant copper color, like it had been freshly minted. He dropped it onto the counter with the others and said, "In my store, shiny pennies are worth double." "They are?" I asked, my spirits buoyed. "Yep, shiny pennies are worth two." And you know what? I believed him. I didn't believe him because I was a kid and he was an adult. I believed him because of who he was. Words spoken by kind people have the ability to endure in our lives. It's over 40 years later, and when I see a shiny penny, I still instinctively think, shiny pennies are worth two. I know what you're thinking. Shiny pennies aren't worth two. And the storekeeper was hatching a plot to ruin my grades in math class. But that's not the case. To him, shiny pennies were worth two, especially if they were my pennies. They might not be worth two at the next store, but in his store, though, he made the rules, and he made that rule just for me. Jesus was always talking about a reverse economy. He talked about if you want to receive, you give. If you want to lead, you follow. That the poor are rich, and you only really live for certain things if you're willing to die to them. What I learned from the storekeeper that day, in retrospect, is eerily familiar and shows me that we have more power than we think to make our own rules about life, to live out the economy that Jesus put in place. We each get to be the storekeeper, at least figuratively, and we decide who gets what and what things are worth. We get to decide that people, including ourselves, are worth more than others might figure, and that following Jesus means doing the math differently sometimes. Because we're all on the same side of the counter when it comes to needing a little help and grace and a shiny penny now and then. Chapter 18. Catching a Ride. I used to think life could be shared with anyone, but now I know choosing the right people is pretty important. Why does spell check make me capitalize Satan's name? I don't want to. It's giving him too much credit. I think Satan exists, but I don't give him a lot of thought. Neither does the Bible, honestly. We talk about Satan way more than the Bible ever talks about Satan. I remember hearing some religious people scare little kids saying things like, "If you listen to heavy metal music, you're under Satan's power." Or, "If you drink beer or smoke, you're under Satan's power." I'd never say that to a kid, because first of all, it'd make them want to listen to heavy metal music and smoke and drink. And second of all, it would make it harder for them to stop because they'd be convinced they were under Satan's power. When I think about Satan, my thoughts go to how Jesus interacted with him in the desert. Jesus spoke to him for just a few seconds and then sent him away. Satan was a manipulator who wanted to control God, but Jesus had a relationship with God that Satan didn't understand, and Jesus had no problem telling him off and getting rid of him. I think we should do the same. That's all I have to say about Satan. He gets too much airtime already. During college, I decided to take some time off and hitchhike around the country. It was a different time back then, and lots of people were doing it. Lots of people were also getting murdered, too, which is why not so many people are doing it anymore. One time, I decided to hitchhike from San Diego to the San Francisco Bay Area. I put my thumb out at San Diego State University, where I was going to college. I got several rides up the coast past Los Angeles and never had to wait for more than a few minutes between them. Mostly, people are nice and are willing to pull over. I had floppy ears and looked harmless enough, too, which helped. There's an unspoken rule when you're hitchhiking. More common sense, I guess. When a car pulls over to give you a ride, instead of telling the person driving where you need to go, you always ask the person where they're going. That will give you a second or two to check them out and see what they're like. If, for instance, they say they're going to a reptile convention or an assault rifle show, you can tell them you've already been there and catch a ride with someone else. At about Santa Barbara, I found myself stuck on the side of the highway for almost a day. After 24 hours, I was desperate to get moving again. Finally, a van pulled over to the shoulder toward my outstretched thumb. I wasn't thinking about anything except getting further north, so I climbed in before the van had come to a stop and threw my backpack in the space between the two front seats. The guy driving looked about 40 years old and had a huge beard. I was a little envious of the beard, actually, and I imagined that someday I could have that kind of wild man look. The windows weren't cracked, and it wasn't long before I caught wind of a toe-curling body odor. I did a quick pit check to make sure I wasn't the source. This guy could have knocked over a water buffalo at 50 yards. No matter. I was moving again, and that was all I cared about. As we picked up speed, I noticed the dashboard was covered in rose petals. That's weird, I thought. Was this guy a florist? I was guessing no, or business must have been pretty slow, because there were no other flowers inside the hollow, creepy, windowless van. On the driver's side, on top of a different stash of flower petals, was a picture of a guy's feet in a gold frame. If you're like me, you're probably thinking this is starting to get a little weird. Why does someone have a picture of a dude's feet framed and set on top of flower petals, I wondered. My best guess was that the bearded stinky guy wasn't a podiatrist. My weirdometer needle was pegged. After fiddling with my backpack a little and looking out the window, I asked the guy, "So where are you headed?" No answer. This is precisely the reason I disciplined myself over the years to always ask someone where they're going before getting in with them. But on this occasion, I'd been stuck in the ice plant by the highway long enough to go to seed and had somehow forgotten my rule. I let a few long moments pass in the off chance he was just taking his time to answer. After a while, I figured that the first question didn't land, so I offered in a cheery voice, "So where are you coming from today? Isn't it a beauty? I love this time of year, don't you?" No answer again. Not a good sign. I continued staring out the van window, trying to put out the I'm not freaked out vibe. Then, without any prompting, the driver turned his head really slowly like the bad guys do in the horror movies. Do you really want to know who I am? He said in a voice covered with emphysema and evil. Sure, I bandied, trying to keep the mood light. We were going to be in the van for a while. Might as well get to know each other. Find areas of common interest. You know, I'm Satan. Oh, I said, kind of wishing I had some holy water in my canteen. I know it wasn't the most probing response, but it was all I could come up with at the time. It also seemed more succinct than, stinks to be you. How's the plan to destroy the world coming? How's your mom? Do you have a mom? In reality, I was totally freaked out. If I had packed my Depends, I would have strapped them on. I told Satan, who I was surprised to note was smaller than me, to pull over and let me out of the van. While it was nice to have been moving again, I figured he wasn't ultimately headed where I wanted to go. Satan acted like I hadn't said anything and kept on driving. Playing it cool, I told Satan more directly that I wanted him to pull over or I'd kick his butt. I think it's good to be direct with Satan, and I figured he probably already heard all the swear words I knew and maybe a few more. Satan pulled over, and I got out. Dust from his creepy, petal-filled, feet-idolizing van swirled around my face as he drove off. I took a shallow breath and tried to shake off the oddity of what I had just experienced. To be completely honest, I was thankful to be safe, and I felt bad for whoever he was going to see next. When I put my thumb out again, I was a little apprehensive. Eventually, a station wagon with peeling, fake wood siding pulled over. It overshot me by 100 yards, and the reverse lights came on. The car rushed backwards on the shoulder, crunching gravel the whole way. The driver was a woman, and as I pulled up to the window, I briefly scanned the back for pitchforks or any other evidence of the underworld. The only unusual thing was a really large black box behind the back seat. Suppressing the thought that it might be the remains of a previous hitchhiker, I asked the woman where she was going, and she said she was on her way to a wedding in San Francisco. That sounded fairly safe, so I climbed in and we pulled onto the highway. After a while, choosing to believe the best in my new traveling companion, I decided to get the conversation going. I asked in a casual voice that I'm sure sounded a little mousy, "Hey, what do you have in the back?" I was almost afraid of the answer before it came. "It's my harp," she beamed, turning to me. "I'm doing the music for the wedding." "Yeah," I laughed. "Your harp, of course." I settled in my seat of her station wagon with a fake wood siding, felt the warmth of the afternoon sun, grinned, and fell asleep. I learned something hitchhiking that day. I learned that even though I needed a ride to get somewhere, I had a lot of power over who I'd hitch a ride with. I know it sounds simple, but life is like that. You become like the people you hang around, and to a great degree, you end up going wherever they're headed. When there's someone else behind the steering wheel, it needs to be someone you'd trust with your life, because you've given a great deal of control over your life to them. Psychologists are now theorizing about the separation of the brain and the mind. The brain is the stuff in your skull, but the mind, they say, works a lot like the internet, a map of information collected from all of our experiences and interactions with other people. In other words, we become connected together and influenced more than we think. If there's a dude who isn't great, and I mean purely evil, it's important to get him out of your mind as fast as possible. Maybe that's why Jesus didn't give Satan much airtime and just sent him packing instead. All this to say that we have a lot more power to decide who we do life with than some people think. And if you make a bad pick like I did, you need to do whatever it takes to get out of the car. I don't mean to sound callous, because the bad ones need friends too. They just don't need you. Jesus doesn't give Satan any grace. He just speaks the truth to him and tells him to go away. If Satan had come back saying he was sorry, that would be different, but of course he doesn't, and he won't. Some people learn to be altruistic and caring, and some people don't. You won't always know right away in the makeup of the people you meet. What I've decided is a pretty good idea is to just ask people where they're going before you get in with them. If they aren't headed where you want to end up, just wait in the ice plant by the highway a little while longer. Chapter 19. Jeepology. I used to think the best teachers wore tweed jackets and smoke pipes, but now I know they flip over and leak. One of my favorite teachers of all time wasn't a professor or writer or even a religious leader. It was a car. Specifically, it was a fire engine red Jeep, jacked so high you could pull your groin getting in. It had a roll bar with a fire extinguisher strapped to it. This Jeep was all guy, a gear and metal manifesto of testosterone. If I could have installed seats made of beef jerky, I would have. A year or two ago, I was driving home from church, and a car came darting out of the side street. It crashed into the side of my Jeep and caught me in front of the driver's side wheel. I didn't have any time to react. I couldn't swerve or reach for the fire extinguisher. I didn't even have time to call out to God. The Jeep started a barrel roll, and I went flying like someone was playing cornhole with my body. I'd like to say I had my seatbelt on, but I didn't. I know, Mom. I was thrown out of the roof of the Jeep like a bullet from a rifle. I regained my senses sitting upright on the asphalt, my arms propped up behind me like I was watching a ball game at the park on a summer day. The Jeep was upside down 30 feet away, and the engine was racing like a phantom foot had the pedal to the floor. Oil and gas were everywhere. Because I'm a guy, I had just one thought. Blow up. It's a guy thing, I suppose. Or maybe I just really wanted to use the fire extinguisher. Alas, the Jeep didn't explode. Maybe next time. Lots of other red vehicles started arriving. A fire truck, an ambulance, two kids on red bikes. I started feeling around to do another limb check. Everything being operational, I got up, dusted myself off, and walked towards the other car. The other driver was stunned and the window started opening slowly. Still clutching the steering wheel, staring blankly forward, was a small, frail woman. She was older, that was easy to see. I introduced myself. "Hi, I'm Bob. What's your name?" The stunned woman kept staring straight ahead, fists clenched around the steering wheel. "I'm Lynn," she stuttered. "Lynn, are you okay?" I asked, leaning forward a little. Lynn was wafer thin. She couldn't have weighed 100 pounds. "I think I'm okay," she whispered. It wasn't surprising that this had left Lynn a little stunned. You see, Lynn was 87 years old. She stood 5'0" on her tiptoes and had been driving home from her senior's exercise class. I tried to make eye contact with Lynn, but didn't have success. "I guess I forgot to stop," Lynn said, still clutching the steering wheel and staring forward. That was indeed correct. But who can be mad at someone like Lynn? Lynn turned her head slowly towards me for the first time in our conversation and said with the seriousness of a grandmother and the surprise of a passerby, "Young man, do you know you just went flying through the roof of your car?" "Oh yeah, that right. I told her that's how I get out of my Jeep when I'm in a hurry. It saves me time by not having to open the door and swing my legs out. I'm a busy guy with things to do, you know." I think Lynn expected me to scold her or tell her why she should be more cautious, but instead, I put my hand on her shoulder. "Lynn," I said in a fitting voice, "I can't lie. That was the coolest thing that has ever happened to me." She looked up and smiled for the first time. I tried to buoy her spirits by continuing, "If there was a ride at Disneyland like that, the line would be a mile long. Can we do it again next week? I'll meet you right here in the intersection." I asked again if she was okay, and she said she was. The police were picking up pieces of my Jeep on a lawn across the street, behind a fence, and down a driveway a short distance away. One of the men from the fire truck helped us swap information. I was fine, so I figured I'd just walk home. But before I left, I called over to Lynn again, waved, and said not to worry. She was still shaken and seemed a little pensive. I walked back to her and asked her what she was thinking. "You know what I'm really concerned about," she said, staring past me. "I don't think I'll ever be allowed to drive again." I tried to empathize with her about what it would feel like and offered her some words of encouragement. Lynn continued, "You know what it is? I just don't want to be dependent on anyone." I knew what she meant. I've never liked being dependent on anyone either. I could empathize with what she must be feeling, and it dawned on me that I might be entering into a season of dependence like Lynn was. The Jeep was totally thrashed as they rolled it right side up. Broken glass glittered on the street and chunks of metal were swept into piles as the Jeep was hauled to the junkyard. It would be weeks or longer before I'd have another set of wheels. Someone was going to have to tote me around. I said goodbye to Lynn as the tow truck, ambulance, and fire trucks pulled away and I walked home. A few days later, I got a call on my cell phone. Hello? There was nothing at first, just empty space. Then a brittle and remorseful voice crawled out of the phone. I am so sorry. It was Lynn. Lynn, is that you? Hey, I'm fine, really, barely a bruise on me. I can't lie, the car could use a little paint, but really, don't give it another thought. You didn't need to call me, honest. I tried to reassure her without much success, and we hung up. A few days later, I was taking a deposition, and my phone rang again. It was the same silence, followed by the frail, I am so sorry. Lynn, I asked. Honest, it's all good. I'm fine, really. You don't need to check in on me. How are the grandkids? Really, no need to call. I was pleasant, and I said goodbye as we hung up, but I could tell this was going to keep happening. Lynn couldn't believe that I'd forgiven her and moved on. I wondered what to do. I didn't want to change my cell phone number, but I also didn't want to get a call from Lynn every other day. So I hatched a plan. I had Lynn's address, so I called the local florist and had them put together a huge bouquet of flowers and deliver them to Lynn. I wrote a note, and I had it stuffed inside the flowers. I asked the delivery person to hang around long enough to report Lynn's reaction. When Lynn came to the door, there was a huge basket of flowers waiting for her. She stood there, more stunned than when she'd flipped my Jeep. The basket of flowers was nearly bigger than she was, and when she opened the card, she started to well up. The card said, "Dear Lynn, it was great running into you. Now stop calling me, Bob." I think Lynn got the message. I was fine, and I wanted her to be fine, too. I wanted her to forgive herself, to realize that we all make mistakes. I'm glad I ran into Lynn, and I'm glad she kept calling me, too. It taught me something about faith. It taught me that when God is big enough and loves me enough to say he forgives me, I should actually believe him. I mean, I shouldn't keep feeling bad about all the times I've messed up, because that's ignoring what God said, just like Lynn ignored what I said. When I don't trust God's forgiveness, it's kind of like I'm saying I really don't believe he's that good. Lynn made me think I should stop asking God to forgive me over and over when he's made it clear he already has. Even though the Jeep was totaled, I bought it back from the insurance company for a couple $1,000s and put some more red paint on it. It definitely had issues. It pulled to the left, for starters. I don't mean a little left, I mean big time left. If I needed to make a hard left turn into the driveway from the street, now all I had to do was hit the brakes. Second, wherever I parked the Jeep in the driveway, it would leave a puddle of oil behind. I'm no mechanic, but I get it. This car had been ridden hard and put away wet. It had been in a terrible collision. No wonder it leaked. There were other glitches, little things that only the owner would notice. Truth is, I wasn't really bothered by all this. The Jeep, despite its new handicaps, was way cooler, tougher, more charming. And now it had a story. Before, it just looked like it had a story, but now it actually had one. And that story made it leaky. I know it sounds goofy, but I want to be like that Jeep. I want to leak from having been hit by Jesus, from having something crazy happen to me, something that flipped my life upside down. I've met people like that, people who leak Jesus. Whenever you're around them, Jesus keeps coming up with words and with actions. I don't suppose everyone gets hit by Jesus, but those of us who have talk about him differently. We start steering funny. We start leaking where we stand, and it's because we got thrown from our lives in a terrific collision. I walked out of my house one Easter morning like Mary to the tomb, and my Jeep was gone. It wasn't in the garage or in the driveway. None of the kids had taken the Jeep out for a spin, and neither had Sweet Maria. I kept checking the driveway, which is only 20 feet long, thinking maybe I'd just overlooked it, or maybe it was down the street, but it wasn't. It turns out it had been stolen the night before. I wasn't mad, just bummed. Really bummed, because my Jeep and I had been through a lot together. Standing in the driveway, I realized it was time to lean into dependence. I thought about Lynn, and I wondered how she was faring with her adjustment to the same. To be sure, I could have gone out and bought a car. I thought about replacing the Jeep the afternoon of the collision with Lynn, but something told me to stop. That same feeling welled up in me again as I gazed lovingly at the day-old oil stain in the driveway. Confession, I don't like needing anybody for anything, and I never have. I'm a lawyer with my own law firm. and I'm almost always on the giving side of an equation, rarely on the receiving side. And that's the way I like it. The morning after my Jeep was stolen, I decided, would be day one of learning a new lesson. I decided that I would learn about being dependent on others. It's been almost a year since my Jeep was stolen, and I didn't replace it. I wasn't trying to go green, I just wanted to learn about dependency. So I headed for the local skateboard shop. I got a Sector 9 longboard to get to work and back on. I didn't make it out of the driveway the first day before I fell. When I did, my first thought was that Lynn would come by and think it was her fault. But I'm getting pretty good now. Mind you, I can't grind the curbs, but I can do a wheelie. Except for skateboarding to work, for the next year, I needed other people to help me get everywhere. Meetings, the airport, or even just to run a simple errand. If I wanted to go somewhere, I needed to borrow Sweet Maria's car or have one of the kids drop me off. This let Maria know even more deeply that she's needed, and it made us work together on just about everything. I had to borrow someone else's stuff to do just about anything. For a guy who likes not needing anything, that's pretty humbling. Even my own kids told me to put gas in their cars when I asked to borrow them. And Dad, don't flip it. That's what they say with a wink as they toss me the keys. Being dependent has helped me see the world in a new way. I'm not as rushed as I used to be. I usually leave for work and return with a big grin because I'm the only middle-aged lawyer on the block carrying a laptop and riding a skateboard to and from work, carving turns along the way. I still miss the Jeep. Sometimes when the phone rings, I secretly hope it's the police and they're calling to say they found it and how much they've learned down at the station. There's an equally good chance, though, that it's just Lynn on the phone again calling to say she's sorry. I doubt I'll ever see my Jeep again, but it doesn't matter. The lessons it taught me are living on in its absence. I'm better now at receiving forgiveness. I hopefully leak Jesus a little bit more, and I'm certainly closer to my family. To be honest, though, I should probably get a car pretty soon. At my house, everyone scatters when I walk into the kitchen, grabbing their keys, shoving toast in their mouth, and running out the door to their rooms. No matter. If I can't get a lift from someone at my house, I'll just call Lynn and see if I can borrow her car. Chapter 20. 10-Year-Old Adventures. I used to think I'd know more about God if I read the Bible a lot. But now, I know I can do something with God and learn more. Sweet Maria and I made a pact early in our marriage. When each of our children reached 10 years old, they got to go on a trip with Dad. We called it a 10-year-old adventure. The idea was simple. The kids got to pick something in the world that captured their imaginations, fanned their whimsy, or sparked their curiosity. Then we'd just go do it together. There was no planning, no preparation, no thinking about all the details. We'd just go do it. Lindsay was the first to turn 10 and loved to have tea parties at the house. She'd heard of an event called high tea that some fancy hotels put on, where you dress up and eat finger sandwiches and drink tea. She asked me if I would take her. You bet. Where do you want to go? I'm not sure. Where do people drink lots of tea? Lindsay asked. London, I think, was my best guess. Well, great. That's what I picked for my 10-year-old adventure. When do we leave? I got on the phone and found a couple cheap tickets on British Airways to London. A week later, we were off. Most great adventures work that way. You don't plan them, you don't wait around and get all the details right, you just do them. On a 10-year-old adventure, the goal is to do everything that you can in the time you've got. You don't know where you'll stay or what you'll eat and all the other details that usually accompany a trip. For 3 days, the kids and I commit to learn as much about each other and the world through what we experience in it, not what we've read about it or planned into it. There aren't any other rules. That's what makes it an adventure, not a program. There's a special relationship between a dad and a daughter, something God designed on purpose, I think. It's not lost on me that of all the names God could have asked us to call him, we most refer to him as Father. I think that's because he has the same kind of relationship in mind for us that I had in mind for my kids. I think a father's job, when it's done best, is to get down on both knees, lean over his children's lives, and say, where do you want to go? Every day, God invites us on the same kind of adventure. It's not a trip where he sends us a rigid itinerary. He simply invites us. God asks what it is that he made us to love, what it is that captures our attention, what feeds our deep, indescribable need of our souls to experience the richness of the world he made. And then, leaning over us, he says, "Let's go do that together." Lindsay and I landed in London and hit the ground running, no waiting to counteract jet lag or pick up luggage. We saw everything we could possibly cram into 3 days. We went to Buckingham Palace, the River Thames, the London Castle, the huge London Eye Ferris wheel. We ran through Hyde Park barefoot, and we tried to make a guard in a bearskin hat giggle. We took in a play in the West End. We ate fish and chips, and we said quite as we toasted each other with soda pops, lifting our pinky fingers toward the Queen. We didn't rest. We didn't sleep. We didn't know where we'd stay, but none of that mattered. And of course, the last thing we did before heading back to the airport was have high tea at the Ritz. We sat bleary-eyed at a small, beautifully appointed, perfectly British table. A stoic server brought us our goodies, and I only made it through one finger sandwich before I saw a 10-year-old girl who would someday be 35 taking her own kids on the same kind of adventures. And I thought about what God must see when he looks at us. Like I saw my 10-year-old turning 35, I imagine he sees who we'll all become too if we start RSVPing yes to his invitations and go after the things he's made us to love. It's not all planned out for us, and that's where most people get too nervous to take the next step. But know this, when Jesus invites us on an adventure, he shapes who we become with what happens along the way. Richard turned 10, and he had barely blown out his birthday candles before he turned to me with a steely resolve of a guy who had just climbed Everest and said two simple words, Half Dome. Richard wanted to hike up the backside of Half Dome for his 10-year-old adventure. He didn't want to go at just any old time either. He wanted to go in the middle of the winter in a snowstorm. I liked his grit. We went to an outfitter that afternoon and picked out a backpack, a tent, a couple sleeping bags, and some boots. That night, we turned off the sprinklers and set up base camp in our backyard. We cooked freeze-dried peaches over our camping stove, told manly stories, and figured out our route up Half Dome from a topographical map neither of us knew how to read. The same rules were in play for his 10-year-old adventure. There would be no stopping, no sleeping, no details. Just a big idea, a willingness to go, and a father who wanted to take him there. We kept our eyes on the weather. One evening, when it looked like the first big storm of the season was going to clobber Yosemite, we frantically packed up the car. We hopped in, and we drove all night. We spent our time eating candy bars, In-N-Out burgers, and talking about what it would be like to summit Half Dome in the snow together. We pulled up to the foot of Half Dome just as dawn was breaking over Yosemite Valley. Within minutes, we had our backpacks on and started hiking. By late afternoon, the storm we had predicted moved in on us. As the storm settled in, we made camp at the base of a steep section of the granite monolith, and we decided we'd hunker down for the night and make a push to the top in the morning. That night, we slept in spurts as more than one bear circled the tent, looking for any food not properly hung in the trees. Thankfully, they weren't interested in human-stuffed sleeping bag burritos. The bears would occasionally brush up against the nylon tent, but we both pretended it wasn't a big deal to us, even though it really was. That's what guys who are together on an adventure do. They don't make a big deal out of everything. The big deal is that they're together. Rich and I woke in the morning to a thick blanket of snow. After a brew of coffee for me and a couple chocolate bars for Rich, we headed further up the mountain above the tree line. What gives Half Dome its name is that it looks like a huge marble circle cut in half, top to bottom. It's the reason climbing it can be treacherous too, because there are no trees and no footholds anywhere. The layer of overnight ice and snow made climbing even sportier. On the way up, Rich was tethered to me by a bright red climbing rope. I would climb a few steps, kicking footholds into the snow, and then Rich would climb in my steps and kick some of his own as we made our way up the steep slope. When we got to our high point, we could see an even bigger storm bearing down on us, and we knew we'd soon be in whiteout conditions. On our way down, I would take a couple steps, and then Rich would take a couple steps. Each time I would take Rich's small feet with my hands and guide them from below into the next step we'd kick together in the snow. We were too excited to be afraid and too engaged in the moment to be thinking of anything else. We made it to the valley 8 hours later and drove home, only stopping for some more In-N-Out burgers. I think God is more of a Half Dome traveler than a Hampton Inn traveler. Jesus doesn't invite us on a business trip. Instead, he says, let's go after those things that inspire and challenge you, and let's experience them together. You don't need a lot of details or equipment, just a willingness to go into a storm with a father who's kicking footholds into the steep sides of our problems while we kick a couple in ourselves too. He guides us into those footholds with his strong hands while we're safely tethered to him by a bright red rope of grace. Somehow in all of this, the terrain we navigate doesn't seem as scary either, because we're on an adventure with God, and we're too excited to be afraid and too engaged to be thinking of anything else. Adam turned 10, and I heard him say he wanted to ride a motorcycle in the desert. That sounded simple enough, a little tame for Adam, actually. Apparently, though, I had heard wrong. He said he wanted to ride a motorcycle across the desert. A big difference. I tried to block out the pictures that came to mind of sun-bleached bones, cow skulls, and guys clawing across the sand with empty canteens and tattered shirts wrapped around their heads. Honestly, I wasn't sure if it could be done, but I figured we'd find out soon enough. We gassed up the motorcycles and left the next day. Any activity where you could lose an eye or a limb is Adam's love language. So when we got to the desert, we headed for the sand dunes. These dunes were different from the 10-footers I rolled down at the beach when I was a kid. These were 700 feet tall. Once you start up one of these monsters in a motorcycle, you need to get to the top without stopping. If you hesitate or try to pause halfway, the result is that you, with a motorcycle on top of you, cartwheel all the way down to the bottom. It's a pass-fail course because there's no in-between. After topping several huge sand dunes with Adam, and then losing track of him for a moment, I heard his motor racing just over the next dune. I made my way over to where the noise was coming from, and it was apparent in an instant that Adam was planning to jump from the top of one sand dune to the top of another. I was yelling, "No!" across a canyon of sand, and it felt like a movie-style slow-motion sequence kicked in as Adam raced through the gears and hit the peak of the dune doing more than 60 miles per hour. Almost immediately, Adam and his machine separated. It was quite a sight, really. He had the look of both Superman and gut-shot pheasant at the same time. Adam landed 120 feet later, surrounded by the scrap metal remains of what he was riding. His first words when I rushed over to him were, "That was awesome." And you know what? It was. Even though things didn't go as planned and Adam crashed and burned, there was a huge sense of accomplishment for him in that. I think God sees our failed launches in the same way. He sees us flying over the handlebars in slow motion, and while he never wants to see us hurt, he knows it can happen from time to time when we live a life of total engagement. I think he sees the outcomes before they happen, too, and calls to us over the noise in our lives, warning of something that won't go well. Like Adam, we often don't hear the warning call and race through the gears, only to find ourselves upside down in the sand. After we come to, he dusts us off, helps us to our feet, and hears us say, "That was awesome." More than once, I've crashed and burned. I've felt him lean in closely to me after picking up the pieces of my life and whisper back to me, "You know what? It was." The kids and I learned about young boys and girls in India who were on a different type of 10-year-old adventure. The worst kind, really. Slave traders in India, called mudalalis, make slaves of young children my kid's age. In order to work off an illegal so-called debt of as little as $10, peasant families would often give a son or daughter to a slave trader as a bonded laborer. Trafficking of this type is illegal in India, but tens if not hundreds of thousands of low-caste children are caught up in it each year. From the work I was doing in the country, I learned of four children being held in a cave behind the house of a slave trader named Gopal. The kids and I left for India that week to try to get them out. We traveled to Chennai in southern India and from there to a small nondescript village 15 hours into the bush. A local contact agreed to sneak these children out of the cave at 1 in the morning when the slave trader wouldn't notice they were gone. We arrived at the meeting spot, and I watched out the windows as my kids fingerprinted the children and documented their stories so that their wrongful imprisonment could be reported to the local head of government. 2 weeks later, we received photographs of soldiers raiding Gopal's filthy cave to free the four children. The soldiers also freed 30 others in the local village who were under the control of other slave traders. That's the way love is. Not unlike loaves and fishes, its impact multiplies. Even though Jesus' disciples were older, they must have felt like my kids did on their 10-year-old adventures. They saw both joy and suffering, triumph and tragedy. And in the end, there was just a man, a big idea, and an invitation without a lot of details. The disciples were unschooled and ordinary, like my kids, like all of us. Yet they didn't need all the details because they were on an adventure with a father who wanted to take them. You don't need to know everything when you're with someone you trust. That's probably why Jesus' disciples never said they were on a missions trip. I think they knew that love already had a name, and they didn't need a program or anything else to define it. We don't either. The kind of adventure Jesus has invited us on doesn't require an application or prerequisites. It's just us deciding to take up the offer made by a father who wants us to come. Chapter 21. Hearing Aid. I used to think God wouldn't talk to me, but now I know I'm just selective in what I choose to hear. During my first year of marriage, Sweet Maria was convinced I had a hearing problem, so we made an appointment to have my hearing tested. A week later, I showed up at the hearing doctor's office and was ushered into a very official-looking testing studio. They gave me some high-tech headphones and a handset with a red button on top to press when I heard a tone. The doctor didn't know how bad my hearing was, and just as a joke, I was going to make her sign to me where to sit, or keep pointing to my ears and shaking my head like I couldn't hear her. I decided against it at the last minute. Next time I'm going to. After the doctor put the headphones on me, she went back to her station and watched me through a glass window. I was hoping she would spin up some Van Halen, but she sent me some very boring sounds through the headphones to determine which ones were within my audibility range. We rang through tone after tone, chalkboard scratching horrible sounds, shrill dog whistle pitches that made me want to howl, low tones Barry White would have envied. I was doing fine on the test to begin with, but as we went along, I found a way to cheat. Every time the doctor sent a tone through the system, she would look up to see if I heard it. I pressed the button every time she looked up, but it didn't matter. I could hear the tones anyway. I was acing this thing. I was sure that if there were an audibility Olympics, I'd be the torchbearer leading us all into the stadium. After a lengthy test covering every frequency known to man, we sat down together to go through the results. The doctor confirmed that I indeed could hear perfectly. It turned out that my hearing problem was nothing of the sort. I could hear well. I was just being lazy and selective in what I heard, tuning out anything I didn't want to hear. During the diagnostic report, Sweet Maria was tapping her foot and giving me the eye. She told the doctor she'd been telling me this for some time, that my hearing was just fine, but I just don't remember hearing her say that. I realized that what was understandably so frustrating for Sweet Maria was a similar issue I have with God. What I mean is, I only hear the things from God I want to hear, and it makes me wonder if he doesn't think I'm going a little deaf. God doesn't speak to me with a voice that makes audio needles move, but there are times when I've sensed something down deep, almost like a tuning fork has been pinged in my soul. It's not just one of those, I know because I know things either. I think we can triangulate the unmistakable tugs of God's voice because we know other things about his character and nature. For instance, we know God loves us and how right forgiveness feels. We also know some truths about the world, like the love we have for our family, or how we've always liked rainy days and cheeseburgers, that sort of stuff. From there, we can get a sense of how God has wired us and use a combination of our hearts and his truths to move ourselves in a certain direction. Some people describe their relationship with God as an ongoing narrative that includes an audible discussion. I lived with a bunch of surfers during college in Southern California, and they would describe hearing God's voice. It often went something like this. So I said, "Hey God, what's up with this?" And then God said, Hey dude, don't worry about it. It'll be cool. God apparently addressed surfers as dude or hey man. Then they'd say back to God, no way. And then God would say back to them, Yahweh, or something equally biblical. All of this head faked me for a while, to be honest, because when I listened for God's voice, I didn't hear anything. No cosmic whispers, no movie reels with subtitles, no still small voice, no booming voice, and no one addressing me as dude or hey man either. I wondered if these surfers were cheating the same way I did in the doctor's office. Maybe they were pretending to hear just because someone like me was looking. It's not that I haven't asked God to talk to me. I've asked for a paragraph, a sentence, a phrase, a word. I've even asked if I could buy a vowel. I told God I wouldn't tell anybody if he would just say one audible thing to me. We'd keep it all attorney-client privilege. Yet still, I haven't heard a thing. So rather than spending time wondering why I don't hear audible voices, I try to listen harder with my heart. And I've realized a couple things that seem kind of obvious now. God doesn't talk to me in an audible voice because God isn't a human being. He's God. That makes sense to me because human beings are limited, and God isn't limited at all. He can communicate to us in any way he wants to, any time he wants to, through flowers, other people, an uncomfortable sense, a feeling of joy, goosebumps, a newfound talent, or an appreciation we acquire over time. It doesn't need to be a big mystical thing like my surfer buddies made it out to be. I haven't seen a combination of tree limbs that look like John the Baptist or a cloud formation resembling Jesus. Honestly, they just look like branches and clouds to me. But I do see the beauty in them, the beauty that's around me, that God made for me and you. I especially see evidence of God in other people's lives. What's beautiful about them always looks an awful lot like God to me. I wonder if the people listening for voices or looking for cloud shapes miss the whisper of God's creation, somehow thinking it's a lesser form of communication, like a text message rather than a whole book on tape. It could just be me, but in all of this, and despite what feels like a handicap at times, I can almost read his lips, inaudibly saying, I love you this much. The more I've listened to God, the more I've realized I don't always catch what God is up to in real time either. Some people speak with a great deal of authority about what God is doing right now. I'm always amazed because I can never figure out God that quickly. I usually understand what God is doing by seeing it through the rearview mirror. Only then can I connect the dots, and even then, it's a pretty dodgy sketch. Maybe that's why the Bible describes what we're often doing as looking through a mirror dimly. The Bible says that right now we only know in part, and that one day, after we're gone, we'll know in full. That makes more sense to me because it means our understanding will always have gaps. Gaps are good because they leave room for God to fill in the spaces. But until all those gaps are filled in, I need to operate on my best guess. I need to listen to that internal tuning fork. Some folks might cringe to think that much of what we do is a best guess about God's desires or aims. But I'm just being honest. Why fake it? I take the fixed points of his character and my particular hard wiring, and I extrapolate from there. There are plenty of fixed points, so we don't need to get worried. There are letters written from prison cells and gospel accounts about how God sees the world and sees us. There are accounts of what Jesus said and sometimes what he didn't say. All of these are good signposts, and they should be enough. Besides, we shouldn't speak with an assurance we don't really have, like we're God's PR agent, and risk misquoting the God of the universe, who could turn us into a pile of salt. This all helps me be a little more respectful and humble when I'm attributing something to God. Most of the characters in Scripture don't hear from God in an audible voice. Even though at one point Moses got the audio version of God and a stone tablet, what the Bible describes about Moses' encounter with God is so much like what God regularly does to me. That is, God didn't give Moses what he asked for. Moses wanted to see God's face, just like I want to hear his voice. In response, God told Moses to get in a big crack in a rock, and God passed by. But when he did, he covered Moses' eye with his hand so that all Moses got to see was God's back. I feel the same way. I think God passes by me a lot, and it serves to show me the direction he's going. We don't always know where he's headed or what to expect along the way, but I think direction is the point, the part and the whole of it. He wants followers, not just onlookers or people taking notes, Plus, I think God knows that if I found out more than just the direction he was going, I'd probably try to beat him there. And if he spoke to me with something audible, I'd probably mess it up and mishear him. I was with my daughter Lindsay at the airport recently. We were talking about whether or not God had a plan for our lives, like lots of people talk about. So I sent a text message to one of Lindsay's friends. "Hi, I'm sitting here with Lindsay," the text message started. I didn't want to creep her out. "I want to know what your plan for my life is." A few minutes later, I got a text message back from her friend. It just had a series of question marks. I could picture her friend thinking, "My plan for Bob's life? Why would I have one?" Lindsay and I kept talking for a few minutes, and I got another text message from her friend. It said, "Bob, my plan for your life is that you would love God." Then a few minutes later, I got another one. "Bob, my plan for your life is that the things you're doing in Uganda would go just great." And a few minutes later, another one. "My plan for your life is that you would love your family." Each of these text messages simply took something this friend knew about me, things she knew about God, things she knew I loved and were good for me, and she simply rolled them into a plan, or stated differently, a hope and a direction for me. It was as though she was saying, "Bob, you know those things that have pinged you, those gifts that are beautiful, those countries and those people that are important to you, the God you love, keep moving towards those." And what she was pointing me towards wasn't mystical or elusive. She just kept pointing me back towards the God I'm trying to follow and the people and places I've been drawn to and the hopes that have emerged within me. That's what Jesus does too. He points us towards himself. I don't think God is giving me the silent treatment because he's mad. I think God's hope and his plan for us is pretty simple to figure out. For those who resonate with formulas, here it is. Add your whole life, your loves, your passions, your interests, together with what God said he wants us to be about, and that's your answer. If you want to know the answer to the bigger question, what's God's plan for the whole world? Well, buckle up. It's us. We're God's plan, and we've always been. We aren't just supposed to be observers, listeners, or have a bunch of opinions. We're not here to let everyone know what we agree and don't agree with, because frankly, who cares? Tell me about the God you love. Tell me about what he's inspired uniquely in you. Tell me about what you're going to do about it, and a plan for your life will be pretty easy to figure out from there. I guess what I'm saying is that most of us don't get an audible plan for our lives. It's way better than that. We get to be God's plan for the whole world by pointing people towards him. Because I don't get the audible version of God, I also look for evidence of where Jesus has been. It's similar to what Luke told a young guy named Theophilus in the Bible. Luke told this young friend to look for many convincing proofs that Jesus was still alive. As a lawyer, that sounds a lot like collecting evidence, dusting for fingerprints. So I've been dusting for fingerprints of Jesus ever since. I look for them in the things that I think I understand as well as the things that I know I don't understand at all. I'm trying to figure out the direction an inaudible God is moving, and I'm using every shard of evidence he's left in the Bible, in my life, and all around me. And you know what? It works. I have an alarm clock that talks to me. I have a computer that talks to me. I have books on tape that talk to me. I even had a navigation system in my car before it got stolen that talked to me. I could pick an accent. I like the one that sounds like my British butler is steering the car. Just for fun, when I have guests in town, I'd sometimes switch the language to have it talk to me in Mandarin Chinese. And you know what? We still got to where we were headed. Like my communication with God, I don't need to hear words I recognize all the time to know what direction God wants me to go, because there's all kinds of other information I can triangulate off of. Could God speak to me audibly if he wanted to? You bet, and I hope he does sometime. I'll let you know, probably in a book called God Talk to Me. Until then, it seems that what God does most of the time when he has something to say to us is this. He doesn't pass us messages. Instead, he sends us each other. Chapter 22. The Puppeteer. I used to be afraid that if I were authentic, I might take a hit. But now, I think being real means I will take a hit. When the kids were growing up, I used to pass by this fancy art gallery pretty often. I'd always glance in and admire the handiwork of some of the talented people. One day, as I walked past, I saw the most magnificent painting I'd ever seen before, hanging on the wall. It was called The Puppeteer. I'm no art collector, that's for sure, but it looked like a pretty cool painting to me. I squished my nose against the window each time I passed by the gallery and I mouthed the words against the glass, "Yes, you will be mine." The Puppeteer is an oil painting of an old guy with his family gathered around. He's dangling a marionette from strings, making everybody laugh. He looks like he's telling everyone a great story. I like that painting because I've always imagined myself of kind of like the puppeteer with my kids and their children gathered around someday. The painting also reminds me of how Jesus invites us to gather around him as he tells us captivating stories about a better life, a bigger life, and a greater love. I asked the guy at the gallery how much the painting was. He started giving me his sales pitch in a muddled accent, and it was hard to follow what he was saying. He told me it was not called a painting, but a piece. I guess they change the name when something is that expensive. Whatever. According to him, the guy who created the painting was an 80-year-old master painter from Europe. I'd looked him up and knew that much was true. The sales guy also said the artist was going blind. Yeah, right.